Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being here with us. Very, very exciting Friday. One that I know many people look forward to, Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. This hour and next hour, weird questions come to us from all over the world via the internet, and then we present them to Jimmy and just sit back and enjoy the answers. So that's what you can do today. I won't be giving out the phone number. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, prolific author, long time apologist here at Catholic Answers. As a matter of fact, yesterday we were talking about 30 years of doing this. So today, 30 plus one day. Jimmy, also the proprietor, of course, of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, welcome.
Thank you very much, Cy Kellett. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm recovering a bit. Everybody's got this thing going around, and I've had it, but I'm getting better. And
good.
What dropped today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Patrons questions episode. So we talked about whether you can be possessed by an angel, the hollow moon theory, the Genesis flood and the Younger Dryas flooding, whether there are actually two Marys in the raising of Lazarus account, how we got the chapters and verses of the Bible, the Aramaic of Lord's Prayer, the Philadelphia experiment, Ouija boards, King Arthur, the Nation of Islam, and more.
Man, and more. After all of that, anytime you get the Hollow Moon Theory and Two Marys in the Raising of Lazarus, that's a pretty good show. I've never actually heard the theory of Two Marys in the Raising of Lazarus. I'll have to go back and read that.
Yeah, it's a theory that's been promoted recently, very recently, by a young scholar who believes she's uncovered evidence in some early Greek manuscripts that the names Mary and Martha, the name Martha in particular, has been altered from Mary. And so she's taken her case to the United Bible Society, and they're going to look at the early manuscripts and see if they think she's right, that it was altered at some early stage, and there are actually two Marys there instead of Mary and Martha.
Ah, man, always somebody thinking of something new. Mary was pretty much the most popular Jewish girl's name at the time, though, right?
Yes, Mary, based on statistical studies that have been done of Palestinian Jewish names, you know, which we find on things like, we find them in literary works, we find them on ossuaries, which are boxes that were used to contain people's bones, so they'd label it whose bones were in it. It's possible for us to do studies of what names were the most common at the time. And Mary was extraordinarily popular. Between the female Jewish baby names, half of all women were either named Mary or Salome.
Holy smokes. Half. So you really needed some, they must have had a lot of diminutive forms of Mary and just other ways of referring to people, or else that would have been confusing.
Yeah.
All right. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. For some reason, I'm not seeing Jimmy Akin. Do you guys know that I'm not seeing Jimmy Akin? But all right. Well, I will.
Makes me more mysterious.
You are more mysterious, Jimmy. So today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which you can get at mysterious.fm, all those patron questions, check them out. Patrick wants to know this, Jimmy. Was it certain or contingent that Adam and Eve would fall, or that the angels would fall?
Certain and contingent are not necessarily mutually exclusive. And in both of these cases, for both human beings and angels, God gave them free will. And therefore, it was contingent that they would fall. They were not programmed to use their free will to fall, because if they had been programmed to do so, it wouldn't have been free will. It would be programmed will. However, God has foreknowledge of the future. So as soon as, you know, in the moment he created humans and angels, he knew how they would misuse their free will. I think the better contrast, rather than certain and contingent, would be determined or contingent. It was not determined that they would use their free will this way, but it was certain they would use their free will this way.
All right. Patrick goes on. He's got several questions, as a matter of fact. I'm just realizing there's a list of them here. So his follow-up to that, I guess, is if it is certain, Could God create other rational beings for whom their fall would be contingent, and could they potentially persist perpetually in the state of grace and obedience to God?
So God could create other rational beings and who would also share free will, and therefore their fall or non-fall would also be contingent. And because it's contingent, some of them might have elected the other option and decided to remain in God's grace and obedience.
Okay, and then continuing with Patrick's question, if it is contingent, could another human couple, same nature, different identity, have persisted in the state of grace and obedience to God perpetually in the Garden of Eden?
Well, if God put another human couple in the Garden of Eden, then yes, they wouldn't have to fall unless Adam and Eve were the federal heads of the race, so that what their actions did would affect every other member of the race. On the federal headship model, if Adam and Eve go down, everybody goes down. It's kind of like, you know, killing the king vampire in a single point of failure vampire story, where you kill the king vampire and all the other vampires die. So if that's how God structured our race, then Adam and Eve going down would take down everybody. If he didn't structure our race that way, then every human would be individual and in terms of their fallenness. And therefore, if Adam and Eve went down, other people could stay in a state of grace.
And Patrick continues. Patrick, you were nothing if not thorough here. For the angels, if they transcend space and time, how do we understand before and after, in heaven and not in heaven, with respect to their fall?
So angels transcend space in that they don't have physical bodies that occupy spatial locations. However, they don't transcend time. There is before and after for angels. So there's a state before angels fell, a state after angels fell. Just like with human souls, there is a state before we die, there's a state after we die and before we're resurrected, and then there's a state after we're resurrected. What may be the case is that angels and human souls in the afterlife may experience time differently than we do. It may be faster or slower, or both faster and slower at different times. Kind of the same way that, you know, you look at some creatures here on Earth, they have different perceptions of time than humans do. Like if you've ever tried to swat a fly, it's really hard, because they're operating at a faster pace than we are. They perceive time going by more slowly than we do. And so to them, we look like we're moving incredibly slowly. However, there are other creatures that seem to experience time moving faster than we do. So they appear to be slow to us, like sloths. Although that doesn't stop baby sloths from being very cute and making very cute noises. So just like we see other creatures here on Earth with different perceptions of time, it may be that angels and discarnate human spirits also perceive time at different rates than we do, but they still have it.
Patrick, thank you very much for that, for the lessons in the fall there of humans and angels. It's about time for us to take a break. I think my wife showed me a video of a baby sloth. Is this going around on the internet? Is that why that came up? Or
I don't know. It's been some time since I've seen a video of baby sloths, but I have seen a video of a baby sloth being very cute and making very cute noises.
All right. We'll take a quick break. Right back with more Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
EWTN, Heavenly Hints.
Memory experts advise us to associate new material with something meaningful. That gives us Catholics not only an advantage, but a way to keep God in our social settings. Stretch your imagination by picturing a Bible in the smile of the next Jim you meet, for instance, or the keel of Noah's Ark for Kelly, a clover for Patrick. Make your connections personal, imaginative, and most importantly, faith-filled.
A heavenly hint from EWTN.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Yesterday, as we mentioned, yesterday was the Feast of Justin Martyr. And so here's what Carrie's got going over at shop.catholic.com. From now through Monday, June 5th, you can save 30% off everything in Apologist's Alley. That's a section of our shop at shop.catholic.com. Just use the promo code Justin in honor of Justin Martyr, and you get that 30% off at checkout. All books, ebooks, MP3s, School of Apologetics courses, and more by your favorite Catholic Answers apologists, 30% off when you use the promo code Justin today through June 5th at shop.catholic.com. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin today. And we enjoy the weird questions, and they get pretty weird sometimes.
So we have a section of the shop called Apologist's Alley?
I guess so. That's what the...
And that's alliterative.
Yeah, it's yes, it is Apologist Alley.
It's not the only alliterative alley I'm familiar with. Have you ever heard Allen's Alley?
No, I don't know Allen's Alley.
It's from old time radio. I forget. So Allen, I forget his first name, was a radio personality.
Maybe Steve Allen, who became the.
It wasn't Steve.
Oh, it wasn't
Allen.
Steve Allen. Okay.
It was somebody else. But he had an alley, a fictional alley that was inhabited by various characters, and he would go down the alley and interview the characters and hear what was happening in their lives, and it was a popular old time radio segment.
Very nice. I like old time radio. I like the theater of the mind kind of stuff. Very clever.
I like Fibber McGee and Molly's Closet.
Now, see, I don't know about their closet.
Oh, yeah. So Fibber McGee and Molly were another pair of old time radio characters. They were comedians, and they famously had a closet in their apartment that was stuffed full of junk. And every time they had to open the closet, all of the junk would come cascading out and make a huge clattering sound on the radio, and people could imagine them just being deluged by all of the junk that came out of the closet. And so frequently you would hear Molly say something like, "Don't open that door, McGee," and then there would be this huge clattering.
Yeah. Sound people had it good in those days. Mm-hmm. Like, lots of jobs for sound people. Darren looks all wistful. Yeah, those were the good old days for sound people. You're doing all right, Darren. You have any sound effects in there, Darren? You got like cheering or something, right? You got one sound effect. All right. I almost gave out the number. Nope, no number. Today is weird questions for Jimmy Akin. And here's a
weird. You know what sound people were called back then?
Oh, I feel like I do know, but now I can't get it. What is it?
They were called, they made sound effects instead of visual effects. Yeah. And the making of sound effects was known as Foley. Yeah. So they were known as Foley artists.
Foley artists. They're still Foley artists today, but I think a lot of their work might be done electronically. I don't know. A lot of, because there's nothing natural in the sound of like a transformer transforming, but somebody's got to come up with the sounds for it.
I remember watching a segment on Mystery Science Theater 3000 once where Joel Robinson was demonstrating imaginative Foley techniques and to simulate the sound of horses' hooves running instead of clapping coconuts together, coconut halves, which is the classic way of doing horses' hooves. He proposed taking a bunch of hamsters and putting them in a drum head over a microphone and sloshing them around.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. All right. Here's another weird question for you, Jimmy. Suppose Middle Earth really existed. Could God become incarnate as a man, an elf, a dwarf, and a hobbit all at the same time? If yes, could man, elf, dwarf, and hobbit Jesus interact with each other and maybe all go out for a pint?
So people, because of how unique Jesus is. People often think of Jesus as if he were the only incarnation God could do. But that doesn't really make sense in terms of God's omnipotence. Omnipotence is the ability to actualize any logically possible state of affairs. And so if you want to say God can't do something, you're going to need to be able to find a contradiction in the terms, where one set of terms logically contradicts another, like God can't make a four-sided triangle because triangles by definition have three sides. So the idea of a four-sided triangle would be a contradiction in terms. Well, the idea of the incarnation is God has a divine nature, and then he assumes a human nature onto that. Well, there's nothing contradictory with the idea of assuming a nature. And if you have infinite capabilities like God does, there's no reason you couldn't assume a second nature and a third nature and a fourth nature or any number of natures. And so I don't see any reason, given that he's omnipotent, why God couldn't assume any number of different natures, including man, elf, dwarf, and hobbit. Assuming those are different species, I don't know that they are. I don't know that they really have different natures, but supposing they do, God is omnipotent. He can do what he chooses, and so I don't see any reason he couldn't choose to do that. Also, there's no contradiction in the idea of different incarnations of Jesus interacting with each other. And therefore, I would assume that they could. It would be within the power of omnipotence for different divine incarnations to interact with each other, including at a pub.
Where you would get a pint. Jacob, thanks very much. Very, very good. Weird question. Fit perfectly. This one comes from Anonymous. I'm a bit of a survivalist nut, and I am always preparing for the collapse of civilization.
As you do.
As one does. I was wondering, if there was a nuclear war or really any kind of catastrophe that would trigger a societal collapse, and the chaos was so widespread that most of the bishops and all of the cardinals were killed, how would the new pope be elected? Could the surviving bishops, who I would imagine would not be cardinals because most likely they'd all be remote rural bishops, elect the new pope? Furthermore, what if all the bishops were killed? Could regular priests somehow advance one of their own to the bishopric? If not, could they at least lay their hands on lay people and continue apostolic succession in that way?
Okay, so any kind of societal collapse that would kill the entire College of Cardinals is very hard to imagine. So this is not going to happen. But for the sake of exploring it, let's propose something that could actually do what you need functionally to create this kind of situation. Let's suppose the Pope has died, and so we're in a seat of vacant period, and the entire voting body of the College of Cardinals has gathered in Rome to elect a new pope. So you've got all of the cardinals who are eligible to vote in Rome to do the election. And while the conclave is going on, someone drops a nuke on St. Peter's and they all die. So you now have no voting age cardinals left in the world. That's the most realistic scenario for, you know, something that would kill a conclave while it's meeting. That's the most realistic scenario to get into this kind of situation. What would happen? Well, the way the apostolic constitutions are written that govern conclaves, there's no provision for that. I think there should be. I think they should create an act of God provision where here's what happens if the whole college is taken down at once. But thus far, they haven't done that. So we're dealing with a praetor legem or outside of the law situation. What would happen in the real world is not that the bishops of the world in general would elect the new pope. Instead, the duty, even though it's not provided for in the law, the duty would logically fall on the ineligible cardinals, those who are past 80 years of age, because they're not required to come to Rome for the conclave. they can, and they can give their opinions, but they don't have a vote. And so the surviving cardinals elsewhere in the world that were not eligible to vote in the conclave would then be called upon to elect a new pope. And they might not elect one of their own number because they're all over the age of 80. And so they might want to say, well, let's pick a bishop who's under the age of 80, because you don't want a super short-reigned pope. He's going to have a lot on his plate, like appointing an entirely new college of cardinals. Now, suppose someone really wanted to do in the church, and so not only did they drop a nuke on the Sistine Chapel, they also dispatched assassins to kill all of the cardinals who were ineligible to vote. So they all get wiped out too, and now we have no cardinals left in the world. Again, we're in a praetor legem situation, but cardinals and the College of Cardinals is not an institution of divine law. Therefore, in emergency situations, you can make other provisions, even though it's not what the law currently provides for. If it's impossible to fulfill the current law, then you can at least pro tem for the moment, deviate from the law in order to do what you need to accomplish. And so then it would be possible for bishops to elect the new pope. And that would be the solution that would be arrived at. Suppose, though, that someone just hated all bishops in the world and had unlimited resources. So, you know, Elon Musk goes super anti-Episcopal, or George Soros goes super anti-Episcopal, yeah, and dispatches assassins to kill every bishop in the world. What would happen then? How would we not only get a new pope, but how would we get new bishops going forward? Well, this is an open question. It depends on the nature of holy orders. But what I can tell you is there are cases in history where popes have authorized priests to ordain other priests. And like the head of an abbey, for example, might ordain one of his own priests. And so there are cases in history where popes have authorized priests to do ordinations without a bishop, and those ordinations have been treated as valid. Now, you could say, oh, but there's only a few of these, and maybe they were mistakes, and we have a better understanding now, and you have to have a bishop to do a valid ordination. But you could also look at it the other way and say, okay, it looks like sacramental abilities, the ability to do all seven sacraments, is tied to the office of priest. And bishops may have some additional functions like jurisdiction that they inherit natively from their episcopal consecration, but the ability to do the episcopal consecration sacramentally is part of the office of priest. And so in that case, you could have priests elect new bishops and continue apostolic succession that way.
Wow. I'm really glad we got that question. Thank you very, very much for the question. I got time to do another one here before we got to go. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Haken. This one comes from Martin. When the Magi came, do you think it made the Holy Family wealthy? For example, enough to travel and stay in Egypt, provide for a 3-year ministry of 13 plus, and for the care of his beloved mother Mary until the Dormition?
No, I don't think it's likely. The reason I say that is that I think that the gifts, including gold, that the Magi gave, and the other gifts, the frankincense and myrrh, were valuable substances that could be resold. I think the funding from that likely helped pay for the Holy Family's flight to Egypt, but I don't think it made the family wealthy, because if you were wealthy, you didn't work a trade. And Joseph and Jesus are clearly tradesmen. In later life, they worked as, in Greek, the word is tekton. It could be translated builder or craftsman or things like that, but they worked with their hands, so they weren't wealthy. And in fact, we have records from the second century of people in Palestine who had things that Jesus and Joseph had made, including, you know, harnesses for animals and things like that, the yokes that you would use to plow with. And so so that's evidence that they weren't made permanently wealthy. Also, regarding Jesus's ministry, Luke 8:3 refers to a group of women who Luke says ministered out of their substance to Jesus and the apostles, meaning they supported them financially. And so they were taking in donations to support Jesus's ministry. He wasn't independently wealthy.
Martin, thank you very much for that question. Lots of great questions so far. Lots more great ones to come because it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin both hours today. Lots of weird questions right after this with Jimmy on Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Are you ready to defend your faith in a world of unbelief? Join us at the 9th Annual Catholic Answers Apologetics Conference. This year's theme, I Believe in God, and it'll help you provide clear and charitable answers to atheism, agnosticism, and plain old indifference. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us in San Diego from September 21st through 24th as we welcome our special guest, Dr. Scott Hahn, and an all-star lineup of great Catholic speakers. Spend quality time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and enjoy 4 days of fun, fellowship, and adoration of the Almighty. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register. Enter promo code EARLY and save $50. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, which is an awful good thing because it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Every now and then we get the opportunity on a Friday afternoon, usually on a Friday afternoon, to get to do Weird Questions with Jimmy, and we like it an awful lot. And so now it has become a thing, and people send us their weird questions. Some of them weird in a kind of secular way. Some of them weird in a kind of more faith-based way, but all of them interesting. And this one comes from Aaron. Where does the idea of toll booths come from? And why didn't it make its way into the Western Church?
Okay, so the toll booths that we're talking about here aren't things that you would find on a turnpike here on Earth. They're what are known as aerial toll booths. And so the idea is that as a departed soul is escorted to be with God in heaven, it, you know, it's taken by an angel, and it encounters various way stations or toll booths in the sky on its way to heaven. And these toll booths are inhabited by demons, and the demons will accuse the soul of various sins. So there's like a toll booth for lust and a toll booth for theft and a toll booth for lying and things like that. And if a person has been guilty of these sins, the demons will accuse it and try to take it to hell. But if the person has been redeemed then and is in God's grace and loves God, then it's not afraid of these accusations, and it will not go to hell. It'll be escorted on by the attending angel and eventually make its way to God. And this idea seems to be this way. What this is essentially a way of picturing what happens in the afterlife as a soul makes its way to God. And the imagery that this way of depicting it is used seems to have a number of sources. One of the sources may be the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, where Jesus refers to angels taking the soul of Lazarus to be in Abraham's bosom. And so that's a possible source for the idea of angels escorting you to your destination in the afterlife. Then there, since we imagine God as being in heaven, in the highest heaven, if you want to imagine going from earth to the highest heaven, you're going to have to go through the atmosphere. And the atmosphere in a lot of Second Temple Jewish and early Christian literature is depicted as the realm of demons. The idea is once you get into the supralunary world beyond where the moon is, you're in the different heavens. Often they're numbered as seven. You see this, for example, in the early Christian document, the Ascension of Isaiah, which was written about AD 67. So it's actually older than the book of Revelation is, but it has seven heavens. And then underneath the first heaven is the atmosphere. And in the atmosphere, you've got all these demons fighting each other. But then once you get into the heavens, they're inhabited by different grades of angels. And you even find references in St. Paul to the devil as the prince of the power of the air. So the idea that the atmosphere is inhabited by demons is something that is already present in Second Temple Jewish and early Christian literature. And that's probably what the Ascension of Isaiah is drawing on, is that stream of thought, and maybe even St. Paul himself for that idea. So if you're imagining how would a soul get to God way up in heaven, it's going to pass through the atmosphere. It may encounter demons. They may accuse it of sins because demons are into doing that. But if you're in a state of grace, if you love God, you're going to get through it okay. There's also another possible source that occurs to me, because one of the earliest references to the toll house concept is in the life of Saint Anthony the Great, and it was written by Saint Athanasius. So Saint Athanasius lives in the early 300s. Anthony is a little bit prior to him. I believe they were contemporaries, but Anthony is from an earlier generation. And both of them are in Egypt. Saint Athanasius was Patriarch of Alexandria. Saint Anthony the Great lived in the desert in Egypt. And that means we need to ask the question whether Egyptian iconography might have had an influence on how Egyptian Christians were picturing things in the afterlife, because we all draw on our cultural background when we are imagining what the afterlife is going to be like. And if you study ancient Egyptian religion, you find out that they had a very interesting and frightening understanding of what happens in the afterlife. They basically thought that the soul of the dead is going to be escorted through a series of different obstacles on its way to the gods, and that at these obstacles there were terrifying monsters that would threaten, among other things, to devour the soul. In fact, there's one beast that you were expected to encounter known as the devourer of souls that would, if your soul weighs more than a feather, if it's burdened down by sins, then the devourer of souls will simply eat you up and you'll go out of existence. So they imagined this terrifying series of encounters with supernatural beings on the journey in the afterlife. And that's similar enough to the toll house concept. I wonder if that may not have had a role in shaping us. And by the way, the reason we know about this Egyptian conception of the afterlife is because of what are known as the pyramid texts, the coffin texts, and the books of the dead. Originally, to guide Pharaoh's soul to the afterlife, they would depict this afterlife journey on the walls of pyramids, including rituals. Now, they're called spells, but really they're rituals. Rituals that Pharaoh could use to get through each of these obstacles. And then, periodically, the government of Egypt would fall apart, and we would have what are known as the intermediate periods, where there wasn't a stable centralized government in Egypt. And during those periods, the pyramids were looted. And so people went into the temples and saw the pyramid texts, and they said, ha, Pharaoh's got special sauce to help you get to the afterlife, to get to the god successfully. I want that too. And so that led to the development of what are known as the coffin texts, where they would take the pyramid texts that were, you know, engraved on the walls of the pyramids and put them on the coffin, on the sarcophagus that a person's buried in. And so you'd be laying in your coffin, you'd have access to all the rituals you needed. Well, that was fine, but coffins are only so big, so you couldn't really fit all of the rituals on them. And so that led to the development of the Book of the Dead. The Book of the Dead is a scroll that, and Book of the Dead just means book owned by a dead person. And so they would write all the rituals to help you get through the obstacle course in the afterlife on a scroll, and they'd bury the scroll with you, and the scroll could be as long as you need to fit all the rituals on it. And so so this was part of the Egyptian religious imagination. I did an episode of Mysterious World earlier this year where I interviewed the Egyptologist Dr. Bob Breyer about the Egyptian concept of the afterlife, including all the material I've just covered. And I can't help but wondering if this didn't have an influence on the way Egyptian Christians like Anthony the Great and Saint Athanasius depicted the soul's journey in the afterlife. So it's another possible source. As to the reason why this didn't become popular in the Western church, it's because we had a different way of envisioning what happens to the soul, and that is purgatory. But basically, both processes, both ways of imagining the soul in the afterlife, imagine that it undertakes a journey to get to God, a series of stages that it passes through. And in the Eastern conception, it moves through the atmosphere for those different stages, whereas in the Western purgatorial conception, it doesn't imagine the soul moving from place to place, but it imagines being the soul being progressively purified as a series of stages that peel away things that would hold it back from being with God. And eventually, in both processes, it ends up with God. And so we do have an equivalent concept to the toll houses, but we use different iconography, different imagery to depict that. And I think that's perfectly legitimate to do. You don't have to picture things the same way. Our minds are not presently configured to understand and process the afterlife. So any information we get about the afterlife and the invisible world around us is accommodated to the perspective of living human beings. It's pictured in ways that we can understand. So that's why biblical prophets, for example, picture the afterlife as a wedding banquet or as having streets made of transparent gold, or things like that. Those images aren't literally true, but they're meant to give us a sense of what this is like. And there are other ways of picturing the journey of the soul in the afterlife. Coming up at the end of July on Mysterious World, I'm going to have an interview with a Dominican friar, Father Nathan Castle, who has a special ministry to souls in purgatory. And what happens is he reports getting dreams of people who died, usually in traumatic ways. And then he and a prayer partner have a prayer session where they try to offer those souls counseling to help them move on in the afterlife and let go of whatever is holding them back from making spiritual progress. And he's got some very picturesque ways of imagining what's happening with these souls. I don't see anything, you know, problematic in that in and of itself. There are different ways of picturing the afterlife. Undoubtedly, to my mind, the afterlife is more complex than we can understand at present. And therefore, all of these toll houses, purgatory, Father Castles, dreams, they're all compacted down and simplified so that we can understand them. But the reality of what's happening should transcend all of them and be even more amazing.
Aaron, what a great question. Thank you so much for that. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. We do have to take a break. We'll be right back with more weird questions right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Hosting Women Made New has helped me deepen my own faith, and I look forward to every weekend having those in-depth discussions with my guests. It's been such a blessing being a part of the EWTN family and carry on the mission that Mother Angelica started.
Women Made New, Saturday, noon Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Very grateful for Aaron's question. That was a fascinating conversation about the afterlife. Thank you, Aaron, very much for that. It's weird questions for Jimmy Akin. And sometimes the questions get really weird, and all you can do is hang on and find out what's coming next. Jimmy Joe wants to know, are the laws of logic and thought, identity, non-contradiction, and excluded middle true of all possible universes or only ours? Would multiverse theories or alternate dimensions modify these rules? And do the laws certainly apply even here? Or could one argue that maybe an extreme form of scotistic...
There you go.
Hesiety. Well, thanks a lot.
Hexaity.
Hexaity. Thanks, Joe. Versus quiddity mean
quiddity.
That mean that maybe they don't. I'm so mad at Joe right now. I'm so mad at Joe.
it's just three words: scotistic, hexaity, and quiddity.
Yeah.
But I acknowledge they are not overly familiar terms to non-philosophers and maybe hard to pronounce.
I should have read ahead. I should have maybe practiced a little bit. Thanks, Joe.
Okay, so I think there can be things that are different about different universes. Like our universe has three spatial dimensions and one temporal dimension, at least as far as we know. Those are the ones that manifest and are obvious to us in this universe. But I can imagine other universes that have different numbers of physical dimensions. There's a famous book from a little more than 100 years ago by Edwin Abbott called Flatland. And it is a really, really good book. The full title is like Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions. And romance in this sense is used, is what they used to call a novel. A novel mm-hmm. was a romance. It didn't mean what we would think of as a romance. And so in Flatland, it's about a world called Flatland that has two physical dimensions. So it's like the flat surface of a table. And a sphere from a third dimensional world visits Flatland and is able to use its three-dimensionality to accomplish effects that look like miracles from a two-dimensional perspective. Like, for example, at one point, the sphere passes through the plane of Flatland. So to a Flatlander, it looks like there's a little dot there, and then it grows into a big circle, and then it shrinks away again to a dot and vanishes. Since he's floating over the plane of Flatland, the sphere can also see inside of the Flatlanders and inside of their houses and tell them what's going on. So it's, to them, it's like remote viewing. It's got preternatural knowledge of hidden things.
Right.
And it can even pick up a Flatlander and move him from one place to another and drop him back down into Flatland. So it's like you got your friend here, poof, he's gone, and poof, he's over there now. And the sphere convinces one of the Flatlanders, a gentleman named A Square, to go and preach the gospel of the three dimensions. And so the Square does, which then gets him in trouble with the circular priests of Flatland, because the gospel of the three dimensions is viewed as heresy. And they're about to execute the Square when the sphere swoops in and snatches him up out of the plane of Flatland and rescues him. The sphere also takes him to a one-dimensional world called Lineland, where everybody is a line segment. So he gets to see what's a world that's even lower in its dimensionality than Flatland is. And what all this is doing is setting us up for thinking about a universe that has more than just the three dimensions that we experience. If there is a four-dimensional world, then an inhabitant of the four-dimensional world could visit our three-dimensional world and do the same miraculous-seeming things that the sphere was able to do with the two-dimensional world. And so you've got some fascinating, you know, geometry and science and religion and social parity all going on in this novel. And so I can imagine universes that have more or less numbers of dimensions. I can also imagine universes that have different constants of nature, like maybe the force of gravity is stronger or weaker, or maybe the electromagnetic force is stronger or weaker. But what I can't imagine is universes that involve logical contradictions. And so I think that the laws of logic that Joe asks about, like the law of identity, the law of non-contradiction, the law of the excluded middle, those are basic principles that I think are going to apply to all worlds. Every possible world is defined in terms of what's logically possible. And so I think the laws of logic are going to apply to every world. Another way of looking at that would be to say, well, God is omnipotent, so God can make anything logically possible. So all of the universes that God could make are the ones that are logically possible. And that means that the laws of logic are going to apply to every universe, because if they didn't, the universe would not be logically possible and God couldn't make it. So God could not make a universe with four-sided triangles in it. But I think the fundamental laws of logic, therefore, will apply to every universe. But there may be subtleties to how the laws work that we haven't perceived yet, because logic grows over time. And, you know, our understanding of it grows over time. And some people have proposed that, okay, maybe we need to qualify the law of non-contradiction to account for the superstates that are proposed in quantum mechanics. Okay, well, that's fine. You could have a more sophisticated understanding of the law of non-contradiction, but fundamentally, the law of non-contradiction is still going to apply, even if it doesn't apply in the naive way that's always been assumed. It still corresponds to a truth, even if you need to understand it in a more nuanced way.
Joe, I'm not really mad at you. Thanks very much for that question. Appreciate it very much. I want to get to this one, though, because this I can read with no difficulty. And
it involves food.
And it produces some anxiety in me as well, because I really want to know the answer. Andy asks, why is most lunch meat round when bread is mostly square?
Okay, so lunch meat, which historically would be most, it's all different. Historically, it's all been different varieties of sausage. You know, I mean, bologna is a type of sausage. Salami is a type of sausage. Fundamentally, you've got sausage as the principal thing you put in sandwiches to make sandwiches. But sausage precedes sandwiches. We've had sausage a lot longer than we've had sandwiches. We have had, it also precedes modern loaves of bread. You know, flatbreads go into antiquity. So you'd have people with like pita bread in the ancient Near East, but they didn't have what we would think of as a loaf of bread. So how did we get sandwiches? Well, reportedly, the sandwich was invented by the fourth Earl of Sandwich in England. His name was John Montague, and he allegedly invented the sandwich, or had his servants invent the sandwich, as a way for him to take a quick bite to eat while he was gambling. Because before the internet, rich people passed time by gambling. And so he's having his gambling sessions, he's playing cards with people, he doesn't want to take time for a full meal, so he has the servants go cut off a piece of sausage and put it between two pieces of bread to keep his fingers clean, and he eats the sandwich. And since he was the Earl of Sandwich, these became, this meal, hand meal, came to be known as a sandwich. Well, so they were using pre-existing materials to make the sandwich. So we need to figure out why the lunch meat is round and the bread is square. We need to think about, well, what was the origin of these things before they got put together in a sandwich? And the answer is sausage historically has been made from, you know, some kind of ground meat being put into a casing. And the casing that people would use, since waste not, want not, was the intestines of an animal. So like you would take pork and grind it up really fine and then shove it into a pig intestine. And that's how you would make sausage. Well, intestines are round, you know, and an intestine is basically a long round tube. And so so that's why sausage and thus lunch meat tends to be round, because historically the molding that it was put into was a round intestine. What about bread? Well, like I said, originally, you know, flatbread goes way back, but at some point after you would have bread made in molds, and the square shape or cubic shape, rectangular shape is the best, is the most efficient space filling shape there is. You know, you can see how it's more efficient than an intestine, for example. You could, if you think about packing a bunch of rectangles into a space versus packing a bunch of cylinders into a space, you will more efficiently fill the space by packing rectangles into it than by packing cylinders into it. And so the square pan or rectangular pan was a more efficient shape for making a mold that you could pour your bread dough into. And so that's why bread ends up being square, because it's made in rectangular pans. Whereas sausage is made historically in intestinal casings, and so that's why it's round. Incidentally, you may have heard the expression, the greatest thing since sliced bread. Mm. And people don't realize this, but sliced bread is a new thing. Bread originally, you know, it came in loaves and you'd have to cut it yourself. But in 1928... An American baker started manufacturing bread that came pre-sliced and putting it in, you know, bags of bread. It was so convenient. Housewives didn't have to cut their own bread anymore. It was great. And that's led to the expression, the greatest thing since sliced bread came in 1928.
We're only 5 years away from the 100th anniversary of sliced bread. Now that I know about that, we will definitely have to celebrate that. I love foods named after the nobility, the sandwich named after the Earl of Sandwich, of course, chocolate named after Count Chocula. Thanks very much, Andy, for that question. We got a lot more weird questions, though, Jimmy. Will you stay for another half hour?
I'll stay for a whole another hour.
Oh, another? Why I said a half hour? What is wrong with me today? All right, we'll do a whole hour. Not a half hour, a whole. I sliced the hour. We'll be right back with more Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.